we'll go ahead and open up this morning. Thank you very much. Call to order the Committee on Judiciary. We have a number of bills up today and a number of representatives. What I want to do on the record, is there anyone here on the way of representatives that need to be moving on to other duties so we can kind of accommodate who needs to be where?
I have committee.
Okay. Speaker, is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Representative.
But I have 20 minutes, so the speaker can go first, unless you can take more than 20 minutes.
I have some.
34, I believe.
34. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3434.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, House Bill 3434 clearly defines 1,000 feet to be the radius from any point on boundary of elementary school, secondary school, career school, or childcare facility.
Thank you. Representative Escobar, how are you doing today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How are you doing today, Floyd?
Doing wonderful.
For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6. Thank you, Madam Speaker. I appreciate it very much. This bill is very simplistic. What happened in Medford, we had a methadone clinic that was sited within 1,000 feet. It was a couple hundred feet short of a preschool, which is against the law. But if you read the law, when I challenged the state of Oregon on why they went ahead and allowed this, they said they took it from the survey. But the survey went zig and then zag instead of a straight line. So I questioned that wisdom, because there's been numerous cases of case law that refutes this. It's a straight line as the crow flies. But according to the state of Oregon, they said it isn't specific enough. So that's what this bill's for, is to make it very specific, that it's 1,000 feet as the crow flies instead of zigging and zagging. Theoretically, according to the state of Oregon, you could live next door to a methadone clinic and have a school next door to it. And if you went around the block the opposite way, you'd be over 1,000 feet away instead of as the crow flies. So that's why it's here.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much. Is anyone else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 3434?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You betcha. Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing, and we're ready for the work session, so we'll open the work session. Senator Dingfelder?
Mr. Chair, assuming there are no amendments, and
there
we don't want to do this in metric as well or something?
No, we do not.
Okay. So House Bill 3434, I move House Bill 3434 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 3434 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I did like the metric idea.
Okay.
But
should we do an amendment and add it in metric as well to make sure in case we change our...
Mr. Chair, that would just confuse me.
I think we did that about 30 years ago.
40. I think it's 40.
That's true.
We're on that slow
track. Okay, we'll go
to the feet. So we'll stay where we're at. Any other questions, any other discussion, any other comments, any opposition to the motion? Not seeing or hearing any, we'll order that to be passed, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3434. Senator Roebling, will you be
here? I would be glad to.
Can I ask you questions about metric as well?
Please.
Okay.
All right.
I like scientific.
Let's see. And which one is speaker?
This one's speaker.
All right, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3327A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3327A authorizes the court to set aside conviction of sex crime listed in ORS 131-881-831A if the person has been relieved of their obligation to register as a sex offender and they have not been convicted of an otherwise non-eligible crime. Authorizes juvenile court to expunge records of persons who were found to be in the jurisdiction of the juvenile court based on that act. If committed by an adult, would have constituted rape in the third degree, sodomy in the third degree, sex abuse in the third degree, or an attempt to commit any of those crimes if a strict set of circumstances are applicable. Those being that the person committing the crime was under 16 at the time, the victim was in 3 years of age of the defendant, incapacity is due solely to the difference in their age, and the victim was at least 12 years old at the time. Declares an emergency to be effective upon passage.
Thank you. Speaker.
Good morning, colleagues, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the Oregon House. I think the summary gives you a sense of what the bill does. This is a bill that Representative Chris Harker and I have been working on, and Representative Harker might be coming in late. He's traveling in from the weekend, but this is a bill that would provide a path to a future for my constituent and his constituent, and and other similarly situated adults. And the bill provides a specific set of criteria and a process by which certain individuals can seek to expunge their criminal record of certain sex offenses committed as a juvenile. And so I'm here on behalf of my constituent who prefers to remain anonymous, who has who is trying to get his life on track, but is not able to come here and testify himself. So I'd like to read his story to you. This is in my testimony, but I'd like to read it for the record, but in case you want to look at it later. So my constituent writes, 10 years ago, I was almost 2 months into my high school freshman year when a chain of events changed my entire life, as well as my family and others involved. My mother told me I took a wrong turn. When I was 14 and just after I turned 15 years old, I engaged in a sexual encounter with a girl who was 2 and then 3 years younger than me. At the time, I did not understand the consequences of my actions. I remember law enforcement came to my high school to talk to me. I was afraid. I wanted to contact my parents. There was no representation in that room for me, not my parents, an attorney, or even a school official. After a plea as an adult at the age of 15, I was placed on probation for 7 years. At that time, I completed everything the court required of me while going to school. I was required to attend weekly treatment sessions, take regular polygraphics, which I passed, monthly visits to meet with a probation officer, probation officer home visits, and yearly registration as an offender, which continues today. I never missed a session or an appointment. My family was and still is my rock of support to help me get through. I know at the time they were hurt and disappointed by the situation, but their support and sacrifice never stopped. My dad decided to retire much too soon, using a portion of his retirement income to retain an attorney for me. He drove me to my sessions every week and occasionally sat in during group sessions when asked. My family did not go on vacations because I could not leave the state. I remember my dad and brother took a trip once and my mom stayed behind with me. They both encouraged me to work hard and graduate from high school, which I did. Even though I completed everything and am no longer on probation, I'm considered unemployable. It's very discouraging to complete job applications only to be turned down, knowing that I could do the job. Every job and apartment I've applied to rejects me after doing a background check. It hurts me because here I am as an adult, now wanting work, and my parents, who should be enjoying their lives, are still supporting me financially. My mom says, quote, to get you through this, we do what we have to do, unquote. Law enforcement still comes to the house once a year to check. My family does not feel comfortable having social gatherings at the house because of the fear that law enforcement will come unannounced. This is not a pity party. All I want is a chance to be independent. I cannot change what happened. I truly have remorse about it. I just want an opportunity to move on with my life. I met this individual almost a year ago now. Actually, I met his father. And to hear the stories and the lack of a future that this young man feels because he's done what he has needed to do. He does not have a path for expungement for this particular crime. The way this bill is drafted is to provide a process. It does not guarantee expungement. It does not guarantee expungement for certain things and for certain individuals. It just provides a path under a narrow set of criteria. And I know this will also be of assistance to Representative Harker's constituent and frankly other adults. There are more stories than you probably want to know about the age difference issues and the different things that go on in this situation. So I encourage your due consideration. I really appreciate you scheduling this bill. It's very important for my constituent and I think other adults like him. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any questions for the speaker? Tina, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What I'm going to do is just take a break right here. I have a number of people who want to give testimony on this bill. I have two other representatives here. Would you like to take your testimony on your bill and let you go on about your duties, or do you want to wait? Okay, well, we'll stay on the roll then. If you're not anxious to move, we'll go ahead and stay on. I got Clarner Boston, I believe, Gwen Griffin, and Elizabeth Suttles, I believe. So, good morning, ladies. Whoever would like to start, if you'll give us your name and your testimony.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Rozanski. Sorry.
Sorry.
Vice Chairs Close and Cruz and other members of the Senate Committee on the Judiciary, Senators Jackie Dingfelder and also Arnie Roblin. I am Corina Boston, Executive Director of Better People, which is located in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3327. Just for your information, Better People is a nonprofit agency that works with individuals who have legal histories. The program was founded by current Oregon State Senator Chip Shields. Senator Shields and I opened the program in June of 1998, and we have completed 15 years of providing services within and to the Portland metropolitan community. We provide cognitive behavior therapy classes using an evidence-based process called moral recognition therapy to help clients change their thinking as a means of changing their behavior. We also provide a job readiness program using a 23-hour thoroughly researched curriculum to help our clients become more efficient and effective in their search for employment. We ultimately help our clients gain employment and also retain jobs once they're hired. From the Justice Policy Institute comes this information. In an effort to pursue dangerous individuals and protect children from sexual violence, legislators have broadly targeted some youth with laws that publicly brands them as sexual predators. This is bad policy because public registers not only fail to protect communities, but they hurt young people by stigmatizing them while at the same time alienating them from crime-reducing social networks like families, schools, and jobs because they're not allowed to be around minors. Facts dismiss some of the more common misunderstandings about youth convicted of sexual offenses. Not a fact. Youth commit a large portion of sex offenses. Fact. Less than 1% of all arrests of youth 17 years of age and younger were for sexual offenses. In 2006, youth 17 years of age and younger accounted for 18% of arrests for sexual offenses. Youth under the age of 15 accounted for 9% of sex offenses, arrests in the same year. Not a fact. Youth convicted of sex offenses will become adults who commit sexual offenses. Fact. Research has shown that a young person who commits a sexual offense is unlikely to commit another one. There are other statistics that support that we should not be stigmatizing all youth involved in childhood sexual situations that requires them to be stigmatized for life by having to register as a sex offender and thereby ostracized because of poorly made and in most cases uninformed and uneducated choices made as a child. My staff and I over the years see the extent to which such laws have adversely impacted clients who have no other charges except those dating back to their childhood. Yet, they continue to pay a hefty price every day of their lives relative to housing, types of employment, social, political, and professional associations, religious affiliations, and any other entity that society deems to be inappropriate as a result of their childhood decisions. This is not justice, and we need to change our legal focus, social understandings, and the laws that govern both. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I will. Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gwen Griffith. I'm a tax lawyer at Tonkin Torp, which is a downtown law firm. We have started what we call the CLIF Project, which is a pro bono legal services project for people who were placed on Oregon's sex offender registry for acts that occurred when they were juveniles. The average age of our client at the time of offense was 13. We see them when they're in their 20s and 30s. We help them get off the sex offender registry because, as you know, Oregon is one of just seven states that registers juveniles for life. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of 3327. I like everything about this bill, except for just one thing, and that it doesn't go far enough. More on that shortly. What I see 3327 doing is matching a little bit better Oregon law with the reality of teenage life. Whether we like it or not, and whether or not we approve, there is sexual activity going on in teenage land. That probably comes as no shock to everyone. For a few very unlucky individuals, they are prosecuted, and this will haunt them for the rest of their lives. And in the world of the internet, of course, I do mean the rest of their lives. Our CLIF clients, the ones that we help, will not be assisted by this bill. But our clients' experience can give you a sense of what it's like to have the stigma, the label of sex offenders. Our clients tell us every day that they cannot get a job, even a menial job. They cannot rent an apartment. And perhaps the most heartbreaking part is when they grow up, fall in love, and have children of their own, they are barred from school premises and cannot coach their son's football team. 3327 takes a very small step to alleviating this problem by allowing people to petition the court for expunction in a very small group. I know that some people object to 3327's approach and similar bills. The argument that they seem to make is that we should never erase any record of any sexual misconduct for any person. I find that argument very troubling. I find it troubling because it's not based on the research or the facts that are in front of us. What the research tells us is that youthful offenders are extremely unlikely to reoffend. The Oregon Youth Authority testified before this committee about a year ago, said that the recidivism rate for treated youth offenders is 4%. So 96 out of 100 youth will not reoffend. With this research in mind, we can be smart about reintegrating people into society. But the beauty of 3327 is that we don't have to delve down into the research. We don't need a posse of social scientists to tell us that this narrowly defined group of youthful offenders, now all grown up and taken off the registry, are not dangerous. The world will be a safe place. They will petition the court, and the court will decide. What worries me most about the absence of expunction for any sex crime is that the tent of sex offenders is a very large tent in Oregon. If you look at the census figures from the latest census in Oregon and the registry, you will discover that one in 100 adult males over the age of 12 in Oregon are on the registry. That's one in 100. So if you know 100 men, probably one of them's on the registry. That's a big tent. And the group that 3327 addresses, they're in this tent because of teenage behavior that our children, our grandchildren, our nieces and nephews, maybe even ourselves, engaged in as teenagers. I think that continuing to punish them punishes us as well. We want to integrate them into our society. I said before that this bill does not go far enough, and I believe that's true. Our CLIF clients will not be assisted by this bill. They continue to be unable to apply for expunction. I believe they're equally deserving. However, House Bill 3327 does take a good step in the right direction to allow this small group of people to launch into adulthood. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My name's Elizabeth Ann Shuttles. I come to you as a mother. Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice President, and members of the committee, in June 2004, the night of his high school graduation, my son, Matthew Shuttles, had sex with his girlfriend. He was 3 weeks past 18, and she was 5 weeks before turning 15. It was totally consensual. He pled to sex abuse 3 and was sentenced to 3 years probation. Matt and I testified before the House and Senate Judiciary Committees in 2007 regarding what was then House Bill 2333, which eliminated the requirement to register for those who met certain limited conditions. The bill was later passed and signed by Governor Kulongowski. Matt was granted relief from registering. At that time, we thought it would enable him to move forward with his life, but have since realized while it relieved the burden of registering, it still did not allow the relief needed. We're asking for your help regarding those who meet these certain limited conditions, not only for Matthew, but for other young people in his situation. As you know, in the state of Oregon, sex offenses are not eligible for expungement. We'd like to see these young people who qualify under House Bill 3327 to be eligible for expungement. These aren't violent predators, but are young people who in fact exhibited poor judgment. It's poor judgment exhibited by many young people. However, only a small portion of these are arrested and charged, as the last person told us. Because sex crimes aren't eligible for expungement, this small group pays a lifetime for this poor judgment exhibited by so many of their peers who don't have to pay this price. From the studying I've done, the rate of recidivism for those convicted of this type of crime appears to be less than 5% within 5 years, though there are not any exact figures for those Romeo and Juliet offenders. As the law currently stands, we are punishing these young people for a lifetime. They have a difficult time securing employment, and if they marry and have families, their income level is usually at a poverty level because they've been convicted of a sex crime and can't get a job. When my husband spoke with the manager of one of our local Goodwill stores, he said, "We don't care what the circumstances may be, they are sex offenders." And most consider Goodwill a kind of employer of last resort. So if they won't help, we have a problem. Matt's worked very hard to move his life forward. He recently completed his degree in web design at Portland Community College. He completed a one-year internship with a national nonprofit and now works there as a junior web designer. He's getting married in August to a beautiful young lady. The problem comes in that he cannot find an apartment on the Portland West Side. Matt works on the West Side and needs to live close to work. But most apartment complexes, at least in the Beaverton area, are owned by corporations that have a policy to never allow anyone who has a sex offense to rent in their complex. Even felonies, after 10 years, they will rent to them. But a sex offense, whether it's a misdemeanor or not, they won't rent to them at all. He and his fiance, they do a background check. He and his fiance lived with us for 10 months until she could get an apartment in her own name. He lives there, but they know he's there visiting all the time, so they don't say much. And he has a job, but if he were to lose that job, the chances of him finding another, even with his experience, are very slim. Most, if not all, misdemeanors are expungible in Oregon. Passing a law such as this would benefit the state of Oregon by allowing these young people to have a future with more possibilities and with little or no risk to the state or society. They can go to college and obtain jobs that will allow them to be taxpayers and not be a drain on society. Many of these young people have a great deal of potential for good if they are allowed to do so. They stand a much better chance of not being reliant on government resources to help support themselves and their families. It's easier for them to find an apartment, giving them more stability. Please give them the chance to contribute and move forward in their lives. Thank you. I also submitted my son's written testimony.
We have that.
He's not here today. He's at work.
Right. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. Our last two signed up individual witnesses, Shannon White and Scott Healy. All right. Scott was here. I know he left for another meeting, so if he comes back, we'll get his testimony later. Shannon?
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is Shannon White, and I'm the Associate Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. Partnership for Safety and Justice is a nonprofit statewide advocacy organization that is very unique in that we advocate both for policies that affect people convicted of crime and victims of crime. We believe we can and should have a public safety system that allows both those groups of people to rebuild their lives. We are here today in support of House Bill 3327 because we know that particularly for youth who get convicted as adults in the adult criminal justice system, the adult felony conviction can create lifelong barriers, as you heard, to both housing and employment. And we know that once youth have been held accountable, we shouldn't have a system that continues to impose barriers to their success. And as you've heard earlier today, the programs that we have in Oregon have been very effective in treating youth who have committed sexual offenses, and there is a very low recidivism rate for those youth. And that is true not just in Oregon, but nationally. Numerous studies have shown that 4 to 14% of youth convicted of sexual offenses will commit another sexual offense. That is in stark contrast to, I think, what we have been told for decades, that people who commit a sexual offense are incredibly likely to continue to do that. And I think now that we have research that shows that that's not the case, that is imperative that we change our policies to conform with that and allow young people to lead successful lives. So I think that's about all I have to say. I think we youth need to be held accountable, and then we need to make sure that they can go on and be successful. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing at this point for House Bill 3327. At this point, we'll reopen that if we have the other people that signed up who want to give testimony. And I'm going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on House Bill 2384A. Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2384A gives law enforcement agencies the option to seize, tow, or impound a vehicle and serve notice of possible forfeiture proceedings on a driver who is pulled over and cited for driving while suspended when the driving while suspended is a criminal offense. It changes the language in the beginning of the bill to say a motor vehicle may be seized for forfeiture so it doesn't leave the impression that the car will be seized and forfeited on the scene. It gives agencies the ability to utilize the criminal forfeiture statute or the civil forfeiture statute. So if the county council opts not to pursue civil forfeiture, the district attorney in that jurisdiction could then take the case and pursue criminal forfeiture. It requires law enforcement agencies to adopt policy and procedures for how they plan to implement this new law to help officers make good decisions out in the field before deciding to issue forfeiture notices and seize vehicles. It removes ORS 811-175 offenders and leaves in 811-182, which is the criminal driving while suspended or revoked offenders or aggravated driving while suspended.
All right, thank you. Representatives, thank you all very much for accommodating the other people, whoever would like to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart, House District 11. I wanted to simply note that the point of this bill is to allow the seizure of a motor vehicle if a person has been cited or arrested for misdemeanor or felony driving while suspended or revoked, or aggravated driving while suspended or revoked, and has been cited or arrested for one of the same in the preceding 3 years. I got involved in this bill in 2010 when a constituent contacted me after she had been rear-ended by a person who was driving with a suspended license and was uninsured. She was unable to get reimbursed for the damage done to her vehicle and her medical expenses. I think it's important to note that as we pursued this bill, we discovered that there were some law enforcement agencies and some district attorneys who were very interested in the bill because they had people who were essentially thumbing their nose at the system because they were able to continue driving, had many, many offenses, and were unable, and we simply were unable to get them off the road. So one of the points of this is to remove the instrumentality of the driving, and that is the car itself. The bill is added, is an added tool to get uninsured and dangerous drivers off the road. It allows law enforcement agencies to use a criminal and civil forfeiture statutes if their local jurisdiction has established a policy to use the tool. That means they needed to have gone in consultation with the local forfeiture attorney and actually worked out what the policy is going to be so that they can be certain that they're following all the forfeiture laws that already exist for other circumstances. Innocent owners of the vehicles are protected under the current forfeiture procedures that are in place and will continue to be. And I don't know whether it's in your record, but I have a letter from dated April 5th, 2013, to me from Heidi Elliott, the Deputy Legislative Counsel, basically setting out the reality that car rental companies, employers, and financial institutions are protected from having their vehicles being seized under this statute. The innocent parties are not subject to being to forfeiture. I know the chair is much more familiar with these laws than I am, so I'm going to stop there.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher?
Thank you, members of the excuse me, I'm having trouble this morning. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Kim Thatcher, representing Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh, and I thank Representative Barnhart for working on this bill last session and allowing me to join forces with him this session to see if we can get something passed. Last fall, my constituent, Sergeant, Sergeant Bill Gill, who is with the Hubbard Police Department, he lives in my district in Kaiser, he came to me very frustrated. He was pulling over folks with, while they were driving with a suspended license, only to issue them a ticket and watch them drive away without a license. And we started out with a much broader bill, as Representative Barnhart mentioned, but we wanted to focus on the worst of the worst. So just kind of give you an idea what universe of drivers we're talking about. Last year in 2012, there were approximately 185,000 people in Oregon who had their driver license suspended or revoked, and that comes to about 6% of the total number of issued driver's licenses in the state. More than 32,000 drivers had more than one conviction of driving while suspended or revoked in the past 3 years. If this bill had been, or this law had been in place, there would have been around 1,350 offenders who could potentially have been impacted by this law because they have been convicted in the past 3 years of one of the crimes listed in the bill. So it's a very narrow group of folks we're talking about, and they're probably the most dangerous ones, and we need to get them off the road. We wanted to start by going after the really dangerous serial offenders, those convicted of driving while suspended or revoked for things like manslaughter, driving under the influence of intoxicants, reckless endangerment, reckless driving, et cetera. So let me tell you about a case I heard about on the radio a couple weeks ago after, I think it was after this bill passed in the House. On May 15th, a 36-year-old Gresham man was allegedly driving, driving his Mercedes recklessly at speeds over 100 miles an hour on Highway 26 from Sandy into Gresham about 6:30 p.m. The suspect slammed into a Mazda driven by a 54-year-old Gresham man on his way home from the hardware store. One witness on the scene said it's like taking a toy car, throwing it on the ground, and watching the pieces explode. The Mercedes caught fire, and officers and bystanders had to pull the driver out of the car. The driver of the Mazda was killed at the scene. The suspect was driving with a suspended license for a variety of crimes, including DUII. His rap sheet goes back nearly 20 years with convictions for drug crimes, first-degree theft, resisting arrest, and unauthorized use of a vehicle. I don't know. But if this new law we are trying to enact would have applied to the suspect, I don't know. I just don't know. But maybe if this tool was in place for the police officers at the scene who had pulled this, or long before this time had pulled this guy over, before this crash had taken place, just maybe this man driving this Mazda home from the hardware store would still be alive, maybe. This bill provides an important tool for officers out in the field so they can use it if they come across one of these offenders. It's
not required to be used. If an agency decides they don't have room to impound a car, or they decide they don't want to mess with it for whatever reason, they do not have to use this tool. It requires agencies to establish their processes and the rules surrounding it if they do want to adopt this. I also want to put out there that we are not, emphasize, we are not changing the forfeiture statute. I know there were many people who wanted to, but we really fended that off. They can do that some other time. All the current protections in the law still apply. There would still have to be a conviction for a crime. Innocent owners are protected, et cetera. And we know that there are many steps that have to take place before an actual vehicle is taken. And this bill, I think, would help us put a very positive step forward in removing some of these worst, these really bad offenders from the road. And I would like Sergeant Bill Gill to actually talk about his experiences.
Sergeant?
Hello, Chair Pozanski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is William Gill. I'm a patrol sergeant for the city of Hubbard, Oregon, and I live in Kaiser, Oregon. I've been a police officer for over 20 years. In the state of Oregon, currently, there are two levels of suspension for drivers. One is suspended while infraction. The other is suspended for driving while misdemeanor, criminal, or revoked. To become criminally revoked, you have to commit a crime in a vehicle, a crime such as DUI, reckless driving, hit and run. There are several others that will qualify that. But when you're suspended at the infraction level, the only thing that can happen to a person is they can be fined or their suspension period can be increased. And there's a level of persons out there, a certain number of persons, who are not intimidated by that. They don't care about being suspended or how long they're suspended. They don't care how much money they owe the state or municipalities and fines, and they continue to drive. And under the current climate, there's been some case law and pressure from our local insurance carriers that have caused many cities and counties within the state to discontinue towing people who are driving while suspended at the infraction level. The problem is, and I've spoke to many police officers across the state and throughout Marion County and local agencies that surround Hubbard, and everybody has their horror stories of drivers who are suspended numerous times. I spoke to a patrol sergeant with the city of Salem, and he had spoke to me about a number of cases. He provided me a driving record of an individual who has been suspended 77 times, administrative suspensions, that in the last 12 years he has had 14 convictions for driving while suspended. And these include numbers of crimes. He provided me another one, 57 suspensions, and in the last 7 years, 13 convictions for driving while suspended. I had contact with an individual last week, and he had 30 administrative suspensions, and in the last 10 years he had a dozen or 13 convictions for driving while suspended. And some of the crimes on his record were for refusing a breath test, hit and run, reckless driving, and driving uninsured. But currently, we were unable to tow that individual. And I personally have had cases where I've stopped people like this, and watching my rearview mirrors, I'm driving away after writing them a ticket, and see them driving off on the road and continuing down the roadway. I can turn around and stop and write them another ticket for driving while suspended, but I have no ability for any further sanction. I'm not able to tow the vehicle, get them off the road, at least initially. And my greatest fear is that I'm going to do that. I'm going to write somebody a ticket for driving while suspended and find out that later they had my ticket in their pocket and they were involved in a fatal crash or a serious injury crash. And so what I'm hoping is that this legislation might give the police officers a tool in which they can get these habitual serial offenders off the road, at least temporarily remove the vehicle, and hopefully save somebody's life or save somebody from serious injury or death. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. I couldn't be more thrilled that Representative Thatcher has shared my concerns and has represented me here at the state capitol with the legislature. And I can't tell you how much it means to me to just know that somebody listens and shares my concerns and gives me the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you very much.
All right. Questions? Senator Roblin?
So, and Representative Barnhart mentioned that insurance companies aren't liable. So they can rent a car to a person with a suspended license and not be accountable for that? I thought they had to have a rental.
I can share with you that most insurance companies, to my knowledge, ask for driver's licenses when they rent a car. Sometimes people will be suspended and still have their physical license in their possession. They may not have the ability or choose to run that person, but many times somebody will rent a car, give it to their brother-in-law, give it to their sister, their cousin, who's suspended. And so there's been a number of times when I myself have ran into those situations. And I've even called the car rental companies at the time and explained to them, hey, listen, I'm trying to confirm whether or not this person has a legal right to drive this car. And many times they ask me to tow the vehicle because they don't want suspended drivers driving their vehicles.
And we can't forfeit the brother-in-law or whoever rented it for him's car.
Well, they will authorize me to impound the vehicle, at least temporarily, but we can't seize it for seize the vehicle from the insurance company or the tow company.
Yeah, and there's a couple of points there. If someone is suspended and they're using your vehicle, you know that they are suspended. You are potentially on the hook for this.
Okay.
We started a program in Eugene years ago where we were actually sending certified letters to registered owners of vehicles that were stopped where someone was driving it while they were suspended to put them on notice so you could take that next step if that occurred. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. And just for the record, because you're talking about innocent people being protected, case of my farm, we have many vehicles. We have blanket insurance for all employees. We have no way of knowing, per se, that one of them is suspended. So my assumption was that our vehicle, he wouldn't be protected, but our vehicle would be at that point. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's my understanding. Now, I think once you became aware, because the person had been stopped, that they were suspended, that you better not let them drive on the roads anymore in your vehicle. But I think before that, you are protected.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, it's just, we have the documentation we get from our employees to make sure that they're legal to work, but for us to do background checks on things like that would be kind of a little over the top. So, yeah. Okay, I just wanted to put it on the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's precisely why we have such a very carefully crafted rule in the forfeiture statute involving basically the innocent car owner, and my belief is, as we reviewed this proposal, that that rule protects the person who doesn't know that the driver is suspended when they let them use the vehicle, regardless of whatever else might be going on.
And Senator Cruz, and Mr. Chair, and Senator Cruz, I understand your position. I'm personally in the same situation where many vehicles are driven by many other people, and we do our best to keep on top of that. But yeah, that definitely want to protect that. Oh, and Mr. Chair,
yes.
I have a couple letters. One is a copy of a floor letter we had on the House Representatives floor, and it was shows an endorsement from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Oregon District Attorney's Association, Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and we have a letter from the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII that I can pass out to you.
All right, thank you. So I do want to put one other thing on the record in the testimony. I want to make sure it's clear. When you look at the summary, it does state that the type of suspensions that are under 811.175, which are violations, are not captured in this. But the ones that are criminal under 811.182 are, and that's both for misdemeanor and for felony driving while suspended or revoke. All right, thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I have a couple other people who signed up for this one. Dinah Biddle and Daryl Fuller and Aaron, why don't you also come up, the three of you. That will make the panel. Good ones. I got Dinah right and not good ones. All right, sorry. One of these years. I apologize.
No problem.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Dinah Vitalins. I'm the Crook County District Attorney and here on behalf of both Crook County and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I've submitted a letter in support of House Bill 2384A from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I just want to make a couple comments about this bill. The issue that came up, that has come up repeatedly, is what are the requirements for protecting innocent owners of vehicles? First of all, an individual has to have a prior criminal conviction before the statute even kicks in. So that person who was suspended because of child support or failed to properly meet some DMV requirement is not going to be captured under this bill. It needs actual knowledge, meaning a prior criminal conviction, and then the second time that they're arrested or stop for driving while suspended, then we have the ability to forfeit the vehicle that they're driving if either they own it or the individual who loaned the vehicle acquiesced, meaning they agreed to the criminal conduct, just like you said, Chair Przanski. And you know we've spent years perfecting both the civil and criminal forfeiture statute and making sure that we do not have, that innocent third parties are protected. And so I just wanted to, two specific protections are if I seize, for instance, Chair Przanski's vehicle and he didn't, and later it comes to be that he didn't acquiesce in the prohibited conduct, meaning he had no knowledge of the fact that somebody was going to drive the vehicle while suspended, he's going to get attorney fees from me and all of his costs returned. That's one protection. The other protection that comes in is, say the vehicle is seized and then we decide not to go forward with forfeiture. All costs of towing, storage, and everything are borne by the government. We cannot charge the individual from who the car was seized with that. And so those are the two issues that have been a concern for car rental companies, and I wanted to make sure that the statute is very clear about that. We worked hard on that during all the years when we were working on the civil and criminal forfeiture statutes. And so I'd ask that you support House Bill 2384 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you. Darrell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police in support of the bill. I want to thank Representative Thatcher and Representative Barnhart for bringing it forward. There's been a lot of really good descriptions of what the bill does and why it's important. I don't want to belabor it other than to state the obvious. There are a number of sheriff's offices across the state of Oregon that are participating in catch and release on a lot of things that are much more serious than driving while suspended because we simply don't have the jail space without the ability to provide a meaningful sanction. These people drive while suspended without any sort of penalty, and we believe this will give us another tool in our toolbox to perhaps get the attention of some of those people, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
All right, thank you. Aaron?
Chairman Przanski, Vice Chair Close, members of the committee. I'm Aaron Jeffers for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do oppose the bill in its current form. We have two concerns. One is that it's still too broad, and two is that the breadth will mean collateral consequences that are serious for lower-income families and families with only one vehicle. You heard a lot of testimony earlier today. You heard the word habitual, serial, worst offenders, people thumbing their nose at the system, and we agree that those are all valid reasons, and the examples given are all valid reasons. Someone with 77 times suspended, 14 convictions for driving while suspended, or 54 suspensions and 13 convictions for driving while suspended, who wouldn't want to take that person off the street by their car? Our concern, however, is that this bill is far broader than habitual. There's a difference, big difference, between habitual, worst, serial, those words that you heard, and repeat, which means just one prior. And so our concern is that we're talking about targeting these serial, habitual drivers, but in fact, the bill goes after people who only have one prior conviction under 811-182. And then their second thing that happens is just an arrest. It's not a conviction at that point. Now, in order for the car to be ultimately forfeited, they would have to have that second conviction. But The car could be seized. It could disrupt the family. If it's the only way to transport kids to daycare or people to work, the effect is going to be very real for those people. I would also like to point out that the protections that are there are legal protections, which require people to have the ability and the time and the money to be able to come into court and enforce their rights under the the forfeiture statutes. And the bill goes a long way to protecting rental companies, car dealers, insurance companies, people who already have lawyers and money and time to come in and protect themselves under those laws. But we would be mindful of the poor families that don't have those resources. And is a second offense really the place to begin creating these problems for those people? There is a notice requirement that where the state has to give notice under the forfeiture statutes, but notice can be as little as serving an inventory receipt on the person who the car was taken from. And then after 21 days, that's the span in which they have to file a claim against it. So I'm not an expert on forfeiture, and I don't really want to confuse the issue that way, but from my reading of the statute, it looks possible for notice to the person they took the car from. 21 days later, you might be precluded from raising that claim. So I'd please like to have someone else speak to that if they can. But again, the main concern is the difference between habitual and repeat. And there is a provision of the statute, 811-182-4, Section G, which deals specifically with habitual offenders. And it says revocation resulting from habitual offender status under ORS 809-640. So there's already a method for determining who habitual offenders are, and it's clearly laid out in that statute. And we would like to see it limited to those serious worst offenders, the habitual offenders, and then we'd feel much more comfortable with the collateral consequences narrowed to that group of people in those instances. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Aaron, I think your statements might not be quite accurate regarding
perhaps not.
Who gets notice. And I'm going to ask Diana to go over this, but my understanding, let's just take the situation of a family co-ownership. Even though there may be husband and wife, the wife, let's say if the husband was the driver that with a suspended license, there'd have to be knowledge on her part and notice to her as one of the registered owners. And I'm also assuming that it, before the forfeiture actually occurs, whoever is on the paper as a owner or if it's has a lien against it, those individuals need to be notified by the state or by the government entity that's going to go through with the forfeiture. Diana?
Chair Prosansky, members of the committee, yes, that's absolutely correct. Any individual who has an interest in the property must receive notice. In addition, we must publish before we get a judgment of forfeiture in a newspaper of general circulation for 4 weeks. I regularly receive pro se claims from individuals. I serve as forfeiture counsel for the Central Oregon Drug Team, and I regularly receive claims from pro se litigants, consider them, and then decide whether or not to go forward with the forfeiture. So everybody gets notice, anybody who has an interest in the vehicle.
All right, thank you. Other questions or comments? And Donna, did you give testimony on the House side on this?
Chair Posansky, yes, I did.
And did the issue of habitual offenders versus the broader net, was that discussed?
Chair Posansky, no, not specifically. At that time, the bill covered all driving while suspended offenses. So it would have covered that child support and all that. And so then we narrowed it to make sure that it had to be a prior criminal conviction. But when you think about it, a prior criminal conviction for driving while suspended, and then you go ahead and get in the car and drive again, I think that's something we want to deter.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Dingfelder, then we'll come back to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I'm reading this right, because I think I see a typo in the statute, in the proposed statute language as well. So maybe counsel can clarify on page, on the first page, line 17 under section 1. I think that should read, has adopted policies and procedures for seizure, including policies relating to when a police officer, it says polices. The way that I read it right now.
Seven.
I think it's missing an I in there.
Okay.
So we'd want to make sure that is correct before it's adopted into statute.
That's correct. It should be policy.
I read a lot of papers.
Well, that's being done. Aaron, you had something else you wanted to say?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Close, members of the committee. I just wanted to say that discussion came up a little bit. In the hearing, we gave essentially the same testimony about the concern for the breadth. It was reduced somewhat, and we're here to repeat again. We still think it's too broad, and it's obviously a policy decision for this committee to make, who to target with these laws. And we have no opposition to targeting serial, habitual, worst offenders at all, and think that there's an easy way in the statute to reduce it just to those people through making it habitual offenders. But currently, we do think that it's broader than necessary, and therefore the collateral consequences will also be broader than necessary.
All right.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. If y'all could step back, I don't believe there's anyone else, but let me just see if anyone else wants to testify on House Bill 2384A. Not seeing anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. This bill, because Eagle Eye Dingfelder has found a typo, we will hold this one over and talk to LC and see what they want to do before we move it forward. And so we'll close, as I said, we closed the public hearing on that. We will be carrying this one over. And what I want to do is go back and reopen the hearing that we had on House Bill 3327A. And Scott, if you're here now, go ahead and take your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Przanski. For the record, my name's Scott Healy. I'm a senior deputy DA in Clackamas County, and I'm also here in support of ODAA. I know that I'd signed up, and it says that we're in opposition, but I don't know if that's altogether accurate, and I want to kind of explain my concerns with the way the bill's currently written. We did testify against it on the House side, but I think that was before it became the A. and Gross version, although I'm not absolutely certain about that. I was asked to come testify on this bill late on Friday, and so I've been doing some research on it, and that's part of the reason that I stepped out. When I take a look at this bill, I was a little bit confused about exactly why, in fact, someone needed to expunge the situation that's explained. As you can see, I guess it would be in subsection, it would be subsection 9, and then little b, big A, big B, because it talks about, the person was under the age of 16, so obviously 15 or younger, at the time of the offense, that the victim has to be at least 12 years of age at the time of the offense, and that if they're within 3 years of age, then it's very narrowly drawn now in the A. and Gross version, and then they can expunge this offense. Well, I was confused about why they were prosecuted in the first place, because under ORS 163.345, and I'm sure, Chair Przanski, you're aware of this, there is a complete defense if you're within 3 years of age, and the sexual conduct is purely consensual, and that's also narrowly drawn by the bill. Then I went and took a look at 163.345, and I don't believe that it includes the juvenile adjudications under 419A and whatever the progeny, and I don't specifically know those statute numbers. So in concept, I would say that the ODAA, obviously we do it for adults. If you're within 3 years of age, then there's no prosecution, basically. I don't understand why we wouldn't do that for juveniles as well, and certainly that's a conversation that we'd be willing to have. But as I take a look at this, and I listened to some of Speaker Kotek's testimony before I had to step out, and she was telling the story, and I would like to know more about that story, because I'm a little bit confused about why that person may be having an issue, but it might be because they were prosecuted under the juvenile laws. Having said that, I think that there's a simpler way to get to where Speaker Kotek and the other supporters of the bill want to go. And I think that this might be, while this would certainly work, it might be a complicated way. If you amended 163.345, which is, as I just indicated, the complete defense bill, if you're within 3 years of age, to indicate that the juvenile sex laws that they adjudicate under apply to that defense, then in the future, you wouldn't have any prosecutions. Because, you know, just like we don't have in the adult world, as long as all these other things are in play, that is, you know, it's purely consensual and the perpetrator or the alleged suspect and the victim are within 3 years of age. That wouldn't necessarily take care of the current issue, though, for, I guess, some of the individuals and maybe the individual that Speaker Kotek was talking about. So you would probably want to make that amendment to 163.345 retroactive. And then, you know, I guess you would also probably need to add it to the expunction statute. Although, I mean, I haven't thought that all the way through because this is relatively new to me. Anyway, I just wanted to tell the committee that clearly there have been people that have been working hard on this. There was, I guess, some, you know, when we were on the other side, I know that there was opposition among the parties. It looks like they've amended it and they've narrowly drawn the amendment now in the in-gross version. I just think that they might be drawing it so narrowly that it applies to this, you know, this one specific situation, but they might then a person would, you know, maybe get convicted as a juvenile and then have to wait a number of years before they could expunge, where we might be willing to have the conversation that, you know, they're never prosecuted in the first place. So that's basically my testimony. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Vice Chair Close pointed out to me and Speaker Kotek's testimony, it appears the individual was tried as an adult as compared to juvenile. And the other thing I wanted to put on the record, that there was another individual who spoke, Ms. Suttle, regarding her son. And his testimony, that's part of the record, says that he was 2 weeks past his 18th birthday, and she, the consenting girlfriend, was 5 weeks from age 15. So I think there is that span where the 3 years difference would not apply as a defense if they're charged as an adult.
Well, so. But in Chair Przanski, though, as I see this bill drawn, then they wouldn't be, because under subsection large C, the person is less than 3 years older than the victim is a requirement, so then they wouldn't be eligible for the expungement either. Isn't that right? Based on what I'm looking at?
Yeah, we're going to look at this because I think there's one other point that's come up. So
okay.
I appreciate you putting everything on the record.
I, you know, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, one other thing I did want to say, too, is that prosecutors, you know, sometimes will, and actually this has been mentioned by some prosecutors when we had conversations about this bill in the past, not when it's as narrowly drawn as it is right now, but prosecutors will, you know, sometimes plea negotiate cases down to say rape 3, sodomy 3, sex abuse 3, when they might be rape 2, as you know, sodomy 2, et cetera, ballot measure 11 offenses to non-ballot measure 11 offenses, and frankly, that's to the benefit of the defendant. If it isn't narrowly drawn enough, and we're going to allow for expungement of these types of convictions and or relief from registration, prosecutors will be reluctant to then plead those cases down, and defendants might not receive the benefit of that bargain. I think that's also something that the legislature should consider in making these amendments. Thank you very much, Chair Przanski.
All right, thank you, Scott. All right, is there anyone else who wanted to get?
Can I have a question?
Oh, sorry, Scott. Sorry, I let you run away too quick.
I'm sorry, I thought you dismissed me.
Senator Robler?
Thank you. I just want to, because you mentioned the idea that if all these conditions were there, including consensuality, and I didn't think that a minor person could consent.
Well, Chair Przanski, Senator Roblin, what we're talking about, and we're talking about legal semantics, basically, okay. Because there's forcible compulsion. You know, we can charge cases. Of course, this would be first degree. If there's forcible compulsion or someone can't consent because of their a mental disease or defect, if they can't consent because they're physically helpless for some reason, of course, if we were to charge a case under those clauses, those would all be first degree. So there's a specific definition for forcible compulsion. I don't have it here right in front of me at this point in time. But basically what we're saying is the state can't prove forcible compulsion beyond a reasonable doubt. So therefore, they're saying, you know, if the sex happened under factual circumstances, I guess, where forcible compulsion wasn't present, or at least we couldn't prove it, then the reason that they can't consent is merely because of, say, the statutory age, which the legislature has already set. So that's what we're talking about, legal semantics. Okay. Clearly, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be confused with the fact that someone under the age of 12 doesn't have the capacity to consent to certain sexual acts.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very
thank
much.
You. Thank you.
And I'll ask one more time. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on 3327A? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing. And
let's see, just told me we can move this if the police has put it, they can fix that.
Okay.
We don't need to get amendments.
All right. So at this point, we're ready to start moving some work sessions. And let me just start off with the last one that's on our list, which is 3253A, is not ready. So it's going to be carried over until tomorrow, which is Wednesday, the 29th already. So that will be the 29th. And then we're going to go ahead and take some public or take some invited testimony on House Bill 2962A. So I'm open up a work session with the purpose of taking some testimony that has been requested because of that bill. And so, Gail, I believe you wanted to come up and give testimony.
3253. And
okay, thank you.
And I'll tell you, before you get started, Mike, why don't you just give us a little preview of what this is for the committee?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the speedy trial bill, as it's been called. We heard this previously, and right now there is an amendment under consideration. It's in front of you as the A3. Essentially, what the amendment would do would not remove the speedy trial statute, but what it would do is it would take the constitutional requirement of speedy trial that requires that the defendant suffer some prejudice and put that into the statutory speedy trial, which isn't there right now. As it stands currently, statutory speedy trial is a calendar counting mechanism. The court determines that if you've hit a certain length of time, they will dismiss the case without prejudice. So what this bill would do is it would import that constitutional standard, which would require the defendant to actually suffer some prejudice before the court would dismiss the case, and that would be a dismissal with prejudice instead of without prejudice. That was what the A3 amendment would do.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Okay, just want to, okay, so basically we could either remove this and the Constitution would cover it, or we can put what's in the Constitution in statute, and so the same thing's covered twice. Interesting.
Well, it's not covered twice. It's not clarity. Uncommon to have something that's in the Constitution that's statutorily stated.
No, that's fine. But basically, what we are doing is changing the statute to exactly mirror what's in the Constitution. Is that correct?
That would be correct.
Okay.
Because what we're doing now is we're giving him more right than currently the Constitution would apply to speedy trial.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Gail, I think it's your turn.
Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Bottom line, our position is this bill still has not received the level of scrutiny and study that we think it deserves. There has been a work group that was held last week. And since that work group, OCDLA has gotten busy. I've got here Denny Mason, who's been doing a 50-state review of other state statutes. Basically, the ABA standards, the American Bar Association standards for state courts, recommends that there be a codification of a state statute for a speedy trial that's separate and different from the constitutional limitation. That has found its way through the federal system and is present in most of the state, other 50 states as well. What we found at the work group, and the work group was attended by a small number of folks, but the representatives from the judicial branch were there. They were able to give feedback by anecdote because apparently the data retrieval system in the judicial branch does not really allow for tracking based on speedy trial dismissals. There was feedback from half of the presiding judges. Two-thirds of them reported that they thought that the statute was a problem, but the other third said they didn't think it was a problem. What we do know anecdotally by talking to other folks is for some counties, they don't have a problem with this speedy trial statute. So those counties are doing something different than are the counties that report that they do have a problem with the speedy trial statute. What that difference is, that differential, is a mystery because we haven't studied it. We don't know. So what my written testimony shows, and we've passed out the written testimony, the American Bar Association has, they publish standards, and their standards are, they recommend to states that they codify a statutory speedy trial provision that sits in specific time lengths of bringing a case to trial. Then they recommend that there be specific stated bases for calculating exceptions to that, and then articulating the consequences to that, which include dismissal with or without prejudice. Now, the ABA standards are pretty clear that jurisdictions should provide adequate resources to the institutions and agencies in order to enable the purposes of the speedy trial statutes to be achieved. That is what is at issue here. We have an underfunded criminal justice system. The ABA recommendations kind of have a hybrid approach, one that hasn't really been seriously considered or discussed amongst the work group, but it's a hybrid from what we've got here. Basically, it says you should set forth an exact length of time that a case should be brought to trial. If it is not brought to trial, then within that time, then there should be a hearing. And at that hearing, the court would have authority to continue that case 30 extra days. And then the court would consider, though, in granting the extension, a number of factors. The gravity of the offense, the reason for the delay, and the extent of the prejudice to the interests of both the defense, the prosecution, and the public. And so basically it's kind of a come-to-Jesus hearing. Now, the federal system has incorporated a lot of those ABA standards. The federal courts have a statutory Speedy Trial Act. It's the Speedy Trial Act of 1974. And the federal system does really exactly what the ABA recommends. It says you should be brought to trial within 70 days. Then it has a long codification of excludable delay. So it's for motions, it's for times when the defendant is outside the district on other charges. If the defendant fails to appear, then that's exempted. If the defendant's undergoing mental competency examinations, that's exempted. Motion hearings, interlocutory appeals, all that stuff. But the federal court's pretty clear. It says no continuance of the time frame in referenced in subparagraph A shall be granted because of general congestion of the court's calendar or lack of diligent preparation or failure to obtain available witnesses on the part of the attorney for the government. So again, the federal system articulates that underfunded and stressed systems is not a basis to go over the statutory speedy trial limit. Then, in terms of sanctions under the federal court, if the trial is not brought to resolution within the time frame as expressly stated, it says here, in determining whether to dismiss the case with or without prejudice, the court shall consider, among others, each of the following factors: the seriousness of the offense, the facts and circumstances of the case which led to the dismissal, the impact of a re-prosecution on the administration of this chapter, and on the administration of justice. It does not incorporate a prejudice standard. And then lastly, we looked at the National Center for State Courts, and I got on their website, and I just keyed in the search phrase speedy trial. Up came all of these studies that the National Center for State Courts, through their Institute for Court Management, had done on different jurisdictions with respect to speedy resolution of trials. And they were thick
studies with graphs and analysis of data. What we don't know here in Oregon is why some counties are not having a problem. Some counties are reporting a problem, other counties are not, and we don't know what that differential is. So we submit that this needs to have a more comprehensive look and examination than what's been done to date, and which can be done in the time frame allowed. Finally, may I suggest that because of the lack of study, I think the legislative history on this bill will be very confusing for the courts. As originally introduced, it had a very articulate effort to codify the exact constitutional analysis. That was abandoned in favor of a more truncated version, which is the A engrossed, which just repeals the statutory speedy trial provision. Now with the A3, it reintroduces the issue of prejudice, which supposedly is from the constitutional analysis. The question really is it the same now analysis as the Constitution, and or is it a different analysis? Something of hybrid approach, perhaps, according to the ABA standards. There's nothing really clearly that sets forth really what this body is intending through these different measures. So with me is Denny Mason. He's done a quick effort to review the 50 other states. He's here to just summarize it for you. But the bottom line is we submit that there really does need to be more discussion before this is ready to go.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Denny Mason. I'm a defense attorney here in Salem, and I'm at 40 out of 50 states, and I think Mr. Knott is doing the same effort, so he may have something to say about this as well, and I think has actually done some of the analysis to call out some of the states. What I've been doing is going through and attempting to find statutes, rules of criminal procedure, court rules, anything that attempts to or appears to attempt to enact the ABA standards. And it looks to me like most of the states have some kind of statutory codification of what the ABA attempts to get at. And I think it's interesting to look at the purposes. And Senator Cruz, I think, kind of was getting at this, although I don't want to put words in your mouth. There is currently a difference between the statutory and constitutional. And the ABA highlights that by saying that the purpose of having, there are three reasons to have this statute, because the constitutional is just about the defendant's right to a speedy trial. The ABA recommends having statutes to affect not only the speedy trial right of the defendant, but also to protect the interests of the public and timely resolution, and to effectively utilize court resources. So the majority of the states have some kind of statute. There hasn't been any particular one that I have seen that is common. Everybody goes about this a little differently. I would like a little more time to get through the last 10 and do some kind of more thorough analysis. But from going through and just looking at the statutes, it looks like most of the states do have something that attempts to accomplish those purposes highlighted in the ABA.
All right. Thank you. Questions? All right. I'm going to ask y'all to step back now. Aaron, you had sent out an email regarding possible supplementing testimony.
Yes.
And why don't you come forward? And Dave Factor, Dave, did you want to put anything on the record regarding any review that the judicial branch has done regarding this issue?
I don't feel compelled to, but thank you for the opportunity.
We just thought we thought we'd share the opportunity with you, but thank you for considering it. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the Legislative Director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. Here to supplement my earlier testimony on this bill. I also spent the weekend looking at the statutory speedy trial regimes for all 50 states, which I do not recommend as recreation. However, I would agree with Mr. Mason's broad comment that virtually every state incorporates some aspect of the ABA's recommendations, including us. A significant aspect of what the ABA is trying to encode and what is often referred to as speedy trial, we have an ORS 136290, which is the statute that says if you've been held in jail for 60 days pending trial and you haven't consented to that, you should be released. That doesn't dismiss the case. That has to do with custody. So when you factor that in, and take the body of states that either require a prejudice analysis or don't have any codification beyond what I just described, which is you can't sit in jail indefinitely while your case is pending. There are at least 14 states that have a current operational prejudice standard within their statutory speedy trial language. Furthermore, that issue of docket congestion, which was raised by the ABA standards, that's coming up all over the country. And while it is true that the federal system says docket congestion cannot be construed in that way, there are at least 10 states that authorize the court to consider docket congestion because they're facing the same budgetary challenges we are. Also, there are at least 14 states that don't start the clock until someone is actually arraigned. Here it's indictment, so that period where a warrant is in the system counts against them. So Oregon really isn't walking the so-called plank here, moving into totally uncharted territory. We're keeping our essential statutory regime, and there are other states that have similar statutory regimes. The modification we're making is simply the insertion of a prejudice requirement. And if you look at the ABA's model rules that were referred to very heavily by Ms. Meyer, 12-2.7, effects of exceeding the speedy trial time limit period. This is the section that says, hey, okay, you've gone over the line. What happens? What's the court's analysis? You go down to sub D, which is, let's see, that would be, boy, little b2D, if I did that correctly. You've got four factors considered: the gravity of the offense, the reason for the failure to bring the defendant to trial within the previously established time limit, the extent to which the prosecution or the defense is responsible for the delay, and the extent of the prejudice to the interest of the defense, the prosecution, or the public that may result.
That's to determine whether or not to grant
an extension. Yes, I know.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I got it. So, again, when you go over, when you're considering, do you get more time or is the case dismissed, there's that P word again, prejudice. And this is something we discuss very heavily at the work group, whether prejudice signals the constitutional language. And the conclusion was, this is the message that it sends. Adding that word prejudice signals your hook to all of those constitutional provisions. It's very clear within the case law what prejudice means. So finally, I've provided you with a short article written about a state with a very strict speedy trial regime, California. And there you see cases being dismissed because there's not a courthouse nearby, because there's not a lawyer available to represent a defendant. This is what happens when statutory speedy trial runs amok. So I hope you'll take the time to read that article, and I'm open for questions.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Aaron? All right. Aaron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So on that one, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session for that public, getting the additional testimony in. And what I want to do is have a work session on House Bill 2601A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2601A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We need an amendment.
We have an amendment that's going to add in a limitation of who's covered on this.
That's right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, dash A5 would limit what red light photos are admissible for to Class A misdemeanors or felonies. So it wouldn't be admissible for any other violations besides running a red light, of course, and Class A misdemeanors or above.
Okay.
So so California stops are going to be okay?
We think they'll be okay. But then they may not be. You still probably get the ticket.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the dash A5s into House Bill 2601A.
All right. Senator Dingfelder moves the dash A5s into House Bill 2601. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2601A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2601A as amended by the A5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to study this further, so I will be a no in committee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, this may have addressed my concerns. I mean, you know, if they, you know, if there's a bank robbery or something like that, and that is, what I don't want to see is photo red light become a fishing derby for law enforcement. and I think this may address that.
And so, that's why it's limited to felonies and
right,
Class A
right.
misdemeanors. So a B
yeah.
and a C misdemeanor or a violation would not be included.
Mr. Chair, I think that the amendment has made it a better bill.
All right, thank you. Any other discussion besides Senator Close? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 2601A to the floor, and we'll close the public hearing. And then what I want to do, excuse me, work session, on House Bill 2384A, Senator Dingfelder brought up the issue regarding a typo. We've heard back from Legislative Council that can be fixed in proofing as they're processing the bill, so we don't need to have an amendment for that. Senator Dingfelder, did you want some opportunity to review this? You did pause on mm-hmm. on it. If you do, I'll carry it over.
Yeah, that I'd appreciate that.
All right, so at this point, what we're going to do is we're going to carry over the following bills. House Bill 2384A to tomorrow. We will be carrying over House Bill 3327A until tomorrow. We'll be carrying over House Bill 2962A till tomorrow. And we'll be carrying over House Bill 3253A until tomorrow. So at this point, everything that's on the agenda will be carried over until tomorrow that was not passed out of committee today. And I show only two that passed, which was 3434 and 2601A. And if that's correct, then we're adjourned for the day. And I think we're back here tomorrow at 8:30, if I'm not mistaken. Please check your agendas. We're closed for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.